Life, culture, and current events from a biblical perspective. 2020 on Vision.
Well, later this month, on the 26th of June, that's just a couple of weeks away, it'll be the International Day Against Drug Abuse and Illicit Trafficking. So, in preparation for that day, and the sorts of conversation you'll hear in the mainstream media, this conversation today about what we are not being told about Australia's drug epidemic. We'll talk about the sanitised terms that are being used to normalise drug use. We'll talk about the real agenda of many policymakers. And we'll identify who is and who isn't allowed to contribute to the public discourse about Australia's drug epidemic. Well, you might like to have your own contribution around some of those sorts of issues. We'll also unpack a whole bunch of developments, you know, things like alarming new trends in drugs being accessed on the dark web, the opioid crisis, now all about synthetic drugs and polydrug use. We may touch on things like chemsex as a rising trend where illicit drugs are increasingly being used to enhance pleasure. And we'll talk all sorts of the usual type topics about marijuana use and medicinal marijuana. Well, you might like to join in our conversation. I've probably got your attention if you have had some sort of history of drug use, or if you, like most people, know someone in your family who is caught up in drug abuse. Well, our special guest over this next hour is Shane Varco. He is Executive Director at Dalgano Institute, a coalition of alcohol and drug educators, and always a welcome guest as we speak into the drug issues in Australia. Shane Varco, a special welcome back to 2020.
Oh, it's good to be back, Neil. Thanks for having me yet again. Appreciate that.
Well, Shane, you've always got such great insights, so I love to be able to talk through these issues with you. And some of the things that we talk about are complicated issues. And your opinions, I got to say, I hold with great respect and they hold tremendous weight. And I know that listeners and those who can remember conversations we might have had before will hold the same thing. Let's start this conversation, Shane, getting a little bit of a context here, because oftentimes we talk about the drug epidemic and for some people that's something that's happening in someone else's family. But when we talk drugs and alcohol, all of these in the mix, an epidemic proportion in Australia, give us some insight into how we get a context for what's going on in Australia.
Well, that's a big question, and I'm trying to give a synoptic answer in that space is a pretty difficult thing to do in the context of where we are right now. But look, the word epidemic is one of those words that's used by people, depending on which side of the debate you're on, you're either used pejoratively or, you know, to enhance or embellish. But to actually say that we've got some serious, serious problems that are being either glossed over or when it suits certain parties to then focus upon and then find that the answer to that epidemic is legalising. I mean, it's like, okay, so it is depending on who's on which side of the debate you're on and what you're trying to do with that agenda. But look, for example, just in southeast Queensland late last year or middle of last year, the police there set up a specific task force to deal with ICE, and particularly ICE use with other drugs in southeast Queensland, particularly the Gold Coast, Brisbane area, Sunshine Coast, because of the amount of young people being caught up in marijuana and ICE particularly, because they're using marijuana and lacing marijuana with ICE to bring them into the ICE space. So they've actually set up a specific task force, which was publicly brought to the table, but it's sort of glossed over pretty quickly. But you've got to be really concerned when a state says, you know what, well, we need to start focusing on stopping this, because 11-year-olds and 10-year-olds, which all states have had this experience, but this is becoming a real problem. That's just one. Of course, the ACT had their inquiry, as the ACT does, into legalising cannabis for personal use. And again, the federal one that we were involved with last year, it fell over, and the federal attempt to change the regulation on that. Northern Territory one fell over as well. The ACT did theirs. Of course, it's already a decriminalised space in the ACT. And of course, drug use is a real problem in that space, and alcohol misuse is a major problem in the ACT. Yet their solution is to legalise after the recommendations. They're thinking, well, of the submissions that were handed in, we think it's probably a good idea to legalise marijuana for personal use in the ACT. Again, It's these permission models. That's what I want to really bring to the fore. It's this ongoing permission model that's increasing the epidemic problem we have, because young people particularly are seeing the grown-ups not caring about legislation, not caring about the rules and what's best practice. And if the grown-ups are doing it and they're pushing it, then what's wrong with kids doing it? Of course, some of those same grown-ups will say, oh, no, kids shouldn't use it, but, hey, wait till you're 18, wink, wink, then start. And so that modelling is a real problem, and that permission modelling is now so endemic in our culture, because we've had this de facto decriminalisation that young people are doing it more and more. Of course, you have a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, well, people are using it, we might as well legalise it. And of course, that's only going to make things exponentially worse. But that conversation is difficult to have in the current climate.
So, Shane, if we're talking about how the epidemic looks, and I know, as you say, this is a huge issue to bring in a nutshell, but when we talk about the alcohol issues, you know, there are people who say, well, that's, you know, contained or it's expanding. You've got, as you say, the marijuana issues, opioids, these sorts of when we talk about dimensions, when you've got prescription drugs, yep, all sorts of just these sorts of things all together is the sort of thing we're talking about today.
Of course, and I think that's a real issue, because there's different layers across the culture. And it's interesting when the pro-drug liberalisers want to promote the idea that, you know, let's let it off the chain. For example, they might say, they'll quote a statistic, say 46% of Australians have used drugs. What they don't say is 46% of Australians have either used an illegal drug or misused an over-the-counter medicine at least once in their lifetime. So that's the stat that comes out of. It's like some other stats that are thrown around on other issues, these wonderful one-liner memes that have become entrenched in culture. The war on drugs example has failed. It's just such a mantra now. There's no evidence for that, because we've never had a war on drugs in this country. We've had that conversation previously. But these statements continue to be thrown around. But in reality, the perception is so becoming so pervasive that people are now stepping into that space more readily, whereas even 5 years ago, they were a bit more reticent about actually having a look at drugs. And, of course, with the advent of the misnomer, or the new version of medicinal marijuana, has also added another layer of permission to the debate that says, well, it's obviously medicine, and kids will buy that that mantra pretty quickly. And so are the middle-aged people. They're sort of 45 to 65 demographic. They're the ones taking up cannabis more and more, as opposed to alcohol, or along with alcohol, because they're told that it's medicinal, has therapeutic properties. And whether the science says so or not doesn't matter. And in fact, I had a conversation just recently about a pro-cannabis user who rang me up after an article we did in the Herald Sundown here in Victoria, that he went railed against me for my comments. And then he told me over the phone that, for example, the science has got it wrong. Yeah. I mean, this is the statement you get from drug users. You know, science has got it wrong. You know, I'm perfectly okay. And then he went on to tell me what, in a disjointed and fragmented way, how cannabis has really changed his life. And I won't begin to talk about the conversation we had, because it was just quite stark, disjointed, and as you would imagine from a drug user. But the concern that I have in this space is that the epidemic is only being added to by these permission models, and any distinct voice is slowly being excised from the debate, because that's impeding the manufactured consensus of drug use normalisation, which is so desperately being promoted by certain and very small but very powerful demographics in the culture.
Okay, so you've got voices being silenced in the debate. Sounds like a lot of other conversations I have on this
Correct.
Program. But you've got people taking sides in the debate. Those who are lobbying for a legalisation, and a lot of our conversation no doubt will revolve around that today. And of course, there are those who are against. And that'll be you and your team, and no doubt most of the people who perhaps are listening in carefully to this conversation today. Then there are those, Shane, who might be the armchair spectator, Not really much idea, not really, you know, maybe forming an opinion, but not really a conviction where they'll actually be bold enough to come out with a conviction that says, no, the permission model doesn't work. What do you think of those who perhaps are in that category right now, forming an opinion, but not yet really holding a conviction about these sorts of issues when it comes to drugs and drug abuse and the drug epidemic in Australia?
Yeah, again, they're the target group, particularly of the pro-drug lobby. Obviously, obviously people on our side of the debate, we're aware of what's going on and how it's working and what the harms that are being done to the community and to particularly families and individuals. So we're a lost cause in their eyes. But you're right, it's the uninformed masses. And this is why, back in 1979, when the head of NORML, National Organisation for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, made a very public statement on video, and which we have and we've circulated, and is on record as saying the best way to get recreational marijuana use in everybody's hands for all people to use is through the medical model. Once we could convince people, quote, that this is a medicine, then recreation door will open very quickly. So again, the idea is what you do, the uninformed masses, the average Joe, and even those who hate drugs but that are dealing with people on drugs and they are genuine harm reductionists, they want to see their loved one not die and their loved one get well, and they want to see mechanisms that don't necessarily criminalize their loved one or at the same time buy into the narrative that and the bad guys come in behind that and they say, yeah, we want to keep your young people alive, your family member alive, so therefore if we do A, B and C, we get pill testing, injecting rooms, needle syringe programs, and all these other programs which have got value if they're done correctly, but once they're hijacked by the normalization mechanism, then all of a sudden it's no longer about exiting drug use, it's about sustained and ongoing drug use, and adding to that self-fulfilling prophecy that, well, see, everyone's doing it, you can't change it, let's just legalize it and make it easier. So that's how the manufactured consensus works in this space. I mean, there's a lot more mechanisms behind the scenes going on than that. But in the public discourse, if you like, as far as policy is concerned, it's very clear what the mandate for the national drug strategy is. You know, the first pillar is demand reduction. Second pillar is supply reduction, my highest priorities. And the third pillar, and a good pillar, is harm reduction, which is supposed to be about keeping those who are caught in the tyranny of addiction in a safer place and in assisting them to exit drug use. Now, that last thing's been excised from the whole process. There's next to no, from those mechanisms such as injecting rooms, and you ask about referrals. You ask about referrals that lead to rehabilitation, and it's almost non-existent. Ask for the data. And even if they do have referrals, it's a piece of paper, the number, if you feel like giving someone a call, give them a call. Now, I'm all for helping people stay alive, and also with opioid substitute treatments, which are helping attempt to help people exit opioid misuse. Again, the exit strategy and sunset clause on those has also been excised. So now we've got people that are on methadone or opioid substitute treatments and end up becoming polydrug users because they continue to use other substances for up to 25 years. So they're swapping out an illegal drug for a legal drug, which is causing almost as much harm because there is no exiting of drug use. Again, because the messaging that's coming through, and this is what's powerful, Neil, and your viewers need to hear this. The messaging is really, really clever, and it's really powerful. And terms like phrased in the terms of inevitability, this can't be done, so therefore, and then we throw in compassion clauses, which we're all for compassion, but compassion always insists on transformation, never simply on servicing a brokenness that continues to maintain its own fragility and its own disease. It can't do that. That's not compassion. That's even not even barely pity. And so we've got a concern where people are buying into the debate and saying, well, this is okay, it's medicine, this is helping people stay alive, it can't be that bad. And of course, behind the scenes, more and more young people are stepping in, and not because they have tyranny of addiction, but because they're led to believe that this is kind of normal behavior. This is what you do, and at the end of the day, if it goes pear-shaped, there's always possibly a way out. You're not going to get in trouble from the police. There is no real legislative framework that's going to hold you account for this. So all these things are starting to mount. And of course, use and introduction to use continues to grow. But you're not hearing those conversations in the media. That's a concern we have.
Well, I did say in the introduction, just 2 weeks out from what is known as the International Day Against Drug Abuse and Illicit Trafficking, trafficking. That's coming up on the 26th of June. Correct. And as we are 2 weeks out, this whole conversation really could be about preparing for what we're likely to see in those conversations in mainstream media that will show some of these terms that you're talking about, inevitability or the compassion factor here. These are sanitized terms that you're saying actually normalise drug use, and just getting the terminology wrong actually leads us in a wrong direction.
Well, I think it's important. Those terms are correct terms. They're very important terms. Compassion is vital. Harm reduction is a good pillar in the national drug system. We've never argued that. But it's how it's interpreted and how it's implemented and how it's exercised. That's the trick. So you can still have the, oh, no, we're just, this is what we're doing. We keep people alive. But underneath, the mechanism has been hijacked by people who are not necessarily against drugs, who in fact want drug use. And what's interesting in the upcoming UN Day on this, their theme for this year is let's develop our lives, our communities, and our identities without drugs. Now, that's the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime. That's their mandate. That's, and the national and international drug conventions are very clear. Drug use is dangerous. It's harmful for the community on so many levels. Nations, GDP, right down to personal health issues and harms to families and broken families. It's just horrendous what drugs do. And no drug addict starts out going with the desire and the longing to be a family-disrupting, culture-destroying drug user. That's not their agenda. It's just, I'm just having a bit of fun. Because it's okay, and I'm not going to. It's not going to be a problem, and everyone's doing it. And so these are the memes that keep being fed into the system. And even though on top you've got this kind of legal and policy framework that says, oh, you know, we want to do this and this and this. But now the pro-drug lobby have just come out point blank and said, well, look, okay, again, the same old mantra, war on drugs has failed, blah, blah, blah. We've not had a war on drugs in this country again since 1985. We stopped our war on drugs. And there's not been a war on drugs internationally either. And our latest DVD, it goes into the history of the war on drugs and how it took nearly 100 years to get drugs out of the currency of trade. So that's another issue. But the key issue here for us is that people are listening and they're listening to what's going on. And is the policy interpretation and is the policy use, is it enabling, endorsing or empowering drug use, or is it remediating, facilitating recovery from, and reducing drug use? They're simple matrix you look at. So how is this policy being used? Is the person in the middle of this harm reduction mechanism or the policy use framework mechanism, are they seeing their drug use endorsed, enabled, enhanced, equipped, or are they actually reducing, remediating from, or recovering from drug use? So that's a simple matrix. You just apply that to every scenario, and if the outcome is not the latter, then you've got to ask a question about the policy capability, because it's supposed to be about keeping off drugs and getting people out of drugs, not endorsing and growing drug use. And again, I quote the UN theme for this year. Let's develop our lives, our communities, and our identities without drugs. That's important.
This is 2020 with Neil Johnson, helping you make sense of life, culture, and current events from a biblical perspective. 2020 on Vision.
1-800-316-316, if you'd like to join in our conversation, what we're not being told about Australia's drug epidemic. And Shane Varco is our special guest. He's Executive Director at Dalgano Institute, a coalition of alcohol and drug educators. And lots of people all of a sudden responding to our call. Let's take some calls, Shane. This will direct where our conversation's going. Let's hear from John in Melbourne in Victoria. Hello, John. Welcome.
Neil, haven't spoken to you for a while.
John, it is a little while.
Yes, yes. Now, can you do me a favour, Neil? Can you not hang up on me if I speak? Because sometimes you've had a tendency to cut people off.
Okay, well, I'll tell you, John... let's get your most important point out first, and then we'll see where we go. There's lots of people trying to get through.
Yeah, really great. Just quickly, I think I understand where you get. I can't remember the guest's name. What was his name again?
Shane.
Shane, sorry.
Yep. Just John.
Yeah, I mean he's got great intentions, and I can understand what he's doing. But what people are failing to realise is that the culture it's no longer a Christian culture we're living in. This is it's a very secular society, and you've got whole cultures now that's swimming in drugs. And the problem you've got is you can't keep anyone honest in this in the drug industry. You can't keep the police, the enforcement honest. There's too much money to be made from drugs. There is such a good lifestyle that people are having on it. And unfortunately, you're like a voice in the wilderness out there. And that, unfortunately, also, the government doesn't help the situation because it keeps these people, gives them free welfare. They get unlimited ambulance service. They get unlimited help. There's no consequences to these people. These people do whatever they want, and the law can't deal with them because obviously in Shepparton there's a courtroom, apparently that's like 5-6 levels for drugs. The whole Shepparton is just 80% of them are doing drugs there. What the hell? There's not much work around. These people are bored. I don't know how you're going to solve this issue. It's a massive issue. We're not talking about a little issue. You're talking about an issue where you can't keep anyone honest in it because the lifestyle is so great. There are people running around with guns, obviously, for the
John,
guns.
You are actually making a fair bit of common sense here, I think. And yep. I think yep. that, Shane, if you're responding here to John, who's making a lot of points, this idea of culture is important here and the culture of drugs. And I like what John says. You know, people are swimming in this drug culture right now. Your response for John?
Oh, look, exactly. What's interesting, as the more John spoke about it, and I agree, as I said, we're not here to talk about Christian culture or not, but we're not coming from a religious perspective here. This is purely from a UN perspective. This is from a humanity and dignity perspective. And the very thing that, you know, as he continued to unfold his commentary, I don't disagree with him. In fact, I've got an anecdote from Shepparton, which I will share. But he talks about, you know, swimming in drugs and young people are bored. And again, starts to buy into the resiliency factor. So what is generating this? And we now know anthropologically, not sociologically, but anthropologically, very important distinction, that this is the most bored generation that's ever lived on the planet, bar none. But it's the most entertained generation that's lived on the planet, bar none. So it's fascinating, right, that anthropologists tell us that boredom's got nothing to do with a lack of entertainment and everything to do with a lack of meaning. This is the profound. So when you disconnect from a sustainable meaning, then what you deal with is within a matrix. This is purely anthropologically speaking, within a matrix of self-indulgence or whatever. Whatever makes me feel okay, for whatever reason I need to feel okay, I will engage. So what happens is people start to look for their bored, and they, once they take a drug and they do have a good experience with that, that becomes their benchmark. And now we know from the science, when a developing brain takes the drug, and I haven't got time to go into the science of this, it's like an atom bomb, a nuclear device going off in their cells as well as their brain, and that wow moment so arrests the amygdala and hippocampus of the brain that it becomes so entrenched. And that becomes the emotional / sensational moment that then by all other moments are rated by. That's why it's so important to keep young people particularly away from drugs up to the age of 25 to 28 because of the developing brain factor. Now, when he starts talking about, you know, once you get their lifestyle, it's rich and people have got guns, we've seen that in Colorado, even though they've legalized everything over there, the cartels are now running more outlets both publicly and privately than ever before. And the crime in Colorado is escalating. Even though drugs are no longer illegal, crime rates, major crimes, acquisitional crimes and violent crimes are increasing because drug use is increasing. And once people are on psychotropic toxins, their behavior changes. And people sitting at home smoking on a joint or sucking on a bong, you know, all of a sudden they're going to be, you know, the model citizens is not the case. And John was unfolding that as he's going. You've got guns, you've got violence, you've got, and on it goes. And so the answer to that is legalize the drug. The answer to that is let's have more of that. The answer to that is, let's not ask hard questions of our dysfunctional culture. The answer to that is, let's not investigate what's happening. And I'll give you that anecdote from Shepparton. I spoke to a major politician some years ago, and they were all for 457 visas and bringing in people from outside to work in the Shepparton region. And this is a staggering quote. And I said, but his unemployment here is high. He says, we can't get locals to fill any of the jobs. One, they don't finish school. This is a quote. They won't finish school, or two, they fail drug tests. And employers cannot have drug users working, particularly in some industries, because their capacity and their abilities are impaired. And because, you know, all drugs have a residual impact on different parts of the body, particularly the psychological functioning. So they can't employ local people because of drug use. and not finishing school. So again, by legalising drugs, we increase the permission again, saying, hey, have at it, guys. This is normal behaviour. Just keep going at it. And there is no mechanism for transition because we refuse to look at the bigger issues around culture, around resiliency, around meta-narratives, around values, all those things that are important for human beings to be just that, human beings.
Let's take a call from Justin, who's been waiting patiently. Hello, Justin. Welcome along.
Hey, Justin.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Good morning, Shane.
Good morning.
Justin, morning. What are your thoughts?
Oh, look, you know, like this whole legalisation thing, you know, like you've only got to look at Colorado 2014, you know, the great experiment of marijuana legalisation and the problems that, you know, I'm a professional health worker and the chronic problems that you're now seeing in Colorado with what they call chronic hyperemesis, where it's people that just continuously vomit and are nauseous and throw up and they can't stop it. This is from cannabis use, which is terrible. The other thing that, you know, the politicians and a lot of people need to wake up to, in the state of Colorado, the latest peer review research found that cannabis-related emergency department visits for psychiatric problems from marijuana use has increased fivefold, which is just a staggering statistic. And fatal car crashes since 2014 due to marijuana use has doubled.
Yep.
Justin, those are amazing and they're earth-shattering figures. Yep. Let's get a thought or two here, Shane, on those figures. Justin, that's scary stuff.
I'm glad he brought that up because, I mean, one thing I wrote an article and submitted a press release earlier this week about increasing road tolls across the country, but particularly in Victoria came out, and also in Queensland, New South Wales. And, of course, certainly using devices while driving was a key factor, but also illicit drugs are now a huge factor. I mean, that was glossed over. So the people against drink and drug driving, which we're affiliated with, we did a press release on their behalf, quoting many of those stats that Justin's just quoted. But in the radio release, it was just talked about, you know, legalising marijuana is absurd because it's going to create more, you know, can create more road accidents. Didn't quote any of that data. And that's a concern we have. It's like the data that's actually in play right now, we got live real-time data that's showing the absolute absurdity and insanity of what it does when you unleash, and that's what you're doing, unleashing a psychotropic toxin through legislation. This is what's going to happen. And you know, we've got enough trouble with alcohol because it's a legal drug. We want to add more to that regimen of legal substances. And this is what's happening. Justin's hit the nail on the head, and I can give you reams of data. In fact, on our website, delganoinstitute.org.au, under Cannabis Conundrum and under Cannabis as Medicine and under Cannabis Library, there is but a fraction, and we're talking hundreds of, literally hundreds of articles there, but it's a fraction of the data in play right now of the harms of cannabis. And we have this constant narrative in the media that this is kind of an inevitable and harmless substance. But we also have people that we know that have the hyperemesis as well, and the shocking impact it does have. It's and so again, thanks Justin for that input, but I could bang on all day about that, but we'll move on to the next call.
Good on you, Justin, from Bunbury in WA. Thanks for being patient and waiting on, and there's a number of calls who've been very patient. Let's take another one. Rosemary is in Melbourne. Hello, Rosemary, welcome.
Oh, good morning, Neil.
Wonderful to hear from you, Rosemary.
Hey, Rosemary.
It's been a little while. What are your thoughts for our conversation today?
Well, first of all, I'm thinking of God, Jesus, and people said to him, why are you having a meal with tax collectors and sinners? And he said, I would have a meal with anybody who made me welcome. I'm thinking of somebody I see just down the road from where whose home is at the car park. And so that's their home at the moment, and a methadone now, not heroin.
Yep.
And God gives people different personalities, but we can always talk to him. And how many friends do you have? Also, I'm realising through vision and through God, it's about being a friend too, selfless like God rather than selfish.
Rosemary, you are bringing to the fore something very important here when we talk about our response, and that is this caution that we have while we're talking about all of these bad things that happen to people who are abusing drugs. that we're cautious not to demonise the person who really is very vulnerable and in significant need. Let's get a response here from Shane. Shane, your thoughts for Rosemary?
And look, this is one of the most difficult conversations to have because we're not talking about what's needed for those who are caught in the tyranny of addiction, as I mentioned earlier. We want to see, as all caring human being, regardless of religious faith or background, any caring human being wants to see a person trapped in this tyranny, and it is a tyranny, to exit that space and become a whole again without drugs. Again, the United Nations theme, let's develop our lives, our communities and identities without drugs. So we want to help those people exit those drug that drug use space. The concern we have is that the mechanisms that are in play to help them exit drug use to recover have been hijacked by certain parties, which is concerning, and all of a sudden the needle and syringe exchange program is now needle and syringe distribution. There's no accountability. There's no comeback. There's no recommendation for and facilitation of moving into a drug use exiting space. The methadone program, is there a sunset clause on that? 2 months, 3 months? No. There's no. It's just as long as you keep wanting to use it, you use it. And we're seeing that being hijacked by unscrupulous people to, again, normalize the drug use. Our question is, do we care enough about these people to help them exit drug use, which means befriending them and whatnot. But our biggest concern, let's get back one, because that's also a great narrative that the pro-drug, sadly, the pro-drug activist, not the genuine, caring, harm reductionist who wants to see people off drugs. We're talking about the pro-drug, the guys who really want drugs unleashed, legalized across the country. They will hijack, and I've heard them do it in public, they will hijack compassion narratives to do just that. We don't want to stigmatize the drug use. We're not talking about that. We're talking about stopping people getting to that space. No one starts life as a methadone addict. No one starts life as a heroin mainliner. No one starts life using meth. They're introduced to it somewhere, and the permission model for introduction to drug use in this country is before 44, the data's clear. 44 to 72% of initial drug use is done either through a friend or curiosity. Now, curiosity and a friend giving it to you are both enhanced and enlarged and empowered by a permission narrative that says, hey, no one's going to worry about this. Try it, man. It's good. I'm doing it. It's okay. Sure, sometimes you have a downer, but it's okay. Have a crack. And as your wonderful lady said, Rose said, they have different personalities, and drugs, like people, are idiosyncratic. One person has a pill at a rock festival, and they have a downer. Another person has a pill and they go, oh, that was fun, but felt sick for 3 days after. Another person had a pill, said nothing happened to them. Another person had the same pill and dies from it because you can't test for individuality in that space. And the concern we have is that we've got this constant narrative saying experimentation is fine. It's going to be part of life. So again, another narrative is heaped on top of the other existing narratives to increase the normalization messaging. And what we're saying is that person in that car park wouldn't exist if drugs didn't exist. Okay. Almost guaranteed.
Thank you so much to Rosemary from Melbourne for your call. 1-800-316-316 if you'd like to contribute to our conversation today. Let's continue to take some calls. Norman is on the line from Queensland. Hello, Norman. Welcome.
Hello. How are you?
Very well, Norman. G'day, Norman. What are your thoughts?
Look, I'd like to just have a little counter view. You know, it's very easy to use statistics from the United States and Colorado. I have no idea what they're talking about in that regard. I don't bother. But I've known for a long time that marijuana's been legal in South Australia and the territories for a number of years. And that's, I think, where you should do your research, you know what I mean? And really, a lot of drug use as opposed to the herb is really relative to accessibility. If there are hard drugs around, they're a smaller component, they're easily accessible, young people will be directed towards them through the social networks. But really to blame marijuana is highly unfair. And I mean, there's a lot of psychosis and criminality in the world that's not related to drugs and suicide that are people who are oppressed by a poor system of greed and corruption. And to blame it on a harmless herb that I know has been around for a long time, and if it was as bad as it's made out to be, we'd all be on the brink, you know what I mean? And in the
Norman,
Bible, there is a reference to marijuana in Genesis, it said, take the herbs, the flower of the herb, and the leaf of the herb, and I believe that's a reference to the herb as an alternative.
I think some people might say you could be reading something into that, but let's get a response here.
Sure.
Shane, you know, is Norman making good common sense here?
Unfortunately, I hear what he's saying. There's a lot of misinformation there. Again, South Australia did decriminalise, and Northern Territory tried to decriminalise substances for a while. They recriminalised them very quickly. WA did the same, particularly with marijuana, because that was the one that everyone seems to think is harmless. I'm not going to get into whatever the narrative and whatever the scriptures talk about. That's for other experts to talk about. My concern is, though, that if what we now know is cannabis use, if it is the, as your listener believes to be, a God-created plant and a God-given plant, then I can tell you right now that the cannabis sativa and cannabis indica that's in play right now has no resemblance to any natural manifestation of cannabis. Cannabis grows naturally. In fact, I think it'd be almost impossible to find a naturally occurring cannabis plant in the world that anyone would want to use. Because a naturally occurring plant, it's because the cannabinoids are in the plant. I won't get into the details of that. There's between 80 and 100, depending on who you talk to. In the science space, there's about 400 different components to cannabis. Very complex plant. But in a natural growing environment, your CBD, one of the cannabinoids called cannabidiol and cannabidiol, actually balances out the THC, which is the psychotropic, the delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol, the psychotropic, gets you high component of cannabis. So when it's grown naturally, it's almost zero impact. We're looking at of course, when this gentleman may have started using cannabis, if he is using it, some 35 years ago, he would have been using the 4% THC to 5% THC weed, or even less. Now we're talking minimum starting points of 21% THC, and if you use different vehicles to ingest, vehicles of delivery to ingest the THC component, some of those deliveries can deliver up to 95, 96% THC. We're talking an experience of people having psychotic breaks, and even now on record, in Germany, on record, as cannabis only, it kills people. This is because it never killed anyone. Cannabis kills people all the time through road accidents, through suicide. In fact, now we know from all the evidence coming out from the major international, and again to debunk, unfortunately, the commentary previously given to us, all the key players in the major terrorist attacks that have been happening globally were either regular cannabis users or were using cannabis prior to detonating their devices. And so this is not an opinion. This is all from autopsies. Cannabis is implicated in this. So it is not the harmless substance that apparently was created how many years ago. This is a completely engineered plant that is now done engineered for one purpose only. And that's what I'm saying. When it comes to cannabis in southeast Queensland, a lot of dealers are icing a tiny bit of ice into the weed. So it gives a double whammy for the person in taking it. And, of course, that kicks in. But any person, and now we know from the science coming out of the US, again, it's on our website, it used to be that those with a predisposition for psychosis are likely to get it if they smoke weed young. Now the science is out. A complete, thorough longevity study says anybody, any young person under the age of 25 who starts smoking or using marijuana, it doesn't matter if it's smoked, eaten or vaped, has the potential of developing psychosis. Everybody is in the boat now. So, again, these are signs that you don't hear. And, again, this is where the narrative gets skewed because we have a one-dimensional narrative that brings up these so-called positive frameworks or just downplaying the negatives. And these mantras keep being retold. And truth, fact, and science are, in fact, excised from the debate. And I would argue, along with my colleagues in the US and UK, that we don't have a war on... We've got a war on science right now, not a war on drugs. We've got a war on science. Because science is being excised from the debate completely for the purposes of creating a narrative that says this is harmless, this should be illegalised because this is what we now do.
Well, I want to thank Norman from Queensland for a contribution, and an alternative opinion is welcome on this program.
Sure.
And because,
absolutely,
Norman, it's still a valuable contribution to our conversation today. Thanks so much for being part of it. Let's take another call. Robin is on the line from Mount Morgan. Hi, Robin. Welcome.
Yes, hello. Yes, drugs is just one of the many, many ways, avenues that the devil is using to destroy mankind. I mean, as a psych nurse before, I knew that link. I could see it. The link between drugs and schizophrenia and other psychoses, that's absolutely. And, you know, and even a Hindu, an ex-Hindu who became a Christian, he wrote a book, Death of a Guru. He became a chaplain in a European university, and he was astounded when these drug users explained the hallucinations they were having, because they were the same demons that he saw in the Hindu trances that he used to be in. And the other thing I wanted to say is that really the bottom line is pain, emotional or physical, is a natural sign that something's wrong. So a person can only postpone dealing with the problem by trying to deaden it. And so that's why people are drawn more and more into those sort of things or any other avenue the devil wants to use to destroy them, because it only goes downhill. It never solves the problem.
Robin, great contribution. Thank you so much for that comment. And do you have a response at all for Robin, Shane?
Oh, look, the spirituality side of things, I mean, that's a conversation for different people. But certainly from I like the concept of... In undoubtedly, that any kind of pain delayed is not dealt with, and I think that's one of the biggest problems. We've got a culture that is irresilient. It doesn't manage emotional, psychological, or physical pain well, and because we have an analgesic mantra in our culture, that, you know, in fact, you look at the which concerns us. We've actually mentioned in our latest DVD resource, Drug Policy: Prevent, Don't Promote, Changing the Narrative. Is we look at the Chemist Warehouse. Sorry, the Panadol ad. That said, when this is the Panadol ad, when pain is gone, life takes its place. It's like, okay, well, what's the subtext of that? Let's reverse that formula. Okay, I can only experience life if there's no pain. So whatever, you know, that's kind of sewn into subtly, almost, you know, hourly on radios and TVs. You know, so, okay, yeah, I'm experiencing pain. I'm not supposed to have pain. I'm not supposed to have any pain. And if I have pain, I just need to deaden it. I just need to anesthetize it rather than address its cause, its origin, and possibly healthier ways to address it and alleviate, remove, or manage that pain. Because, and that's where resilience is. A resilient person has the capacity to deal with trauma and difficulty and duress with well-managed problem-solving skills, persistence of will, all founded on a sustainable hope. Now, that is a clear definition of resiliency that we use in our education models. And so when people are in that space, they're more resilient. And sure, pain is awful, we need to manage it, but what's causing it? And let's deal with the cause rather than simply alleviate the symptom, as your listeners so rightly put out. As an ex-psych nurse, she gets that, because it just masks the issue, it doesn't address the issue, and once you take the substance out, guess what happens? It comes back twice as hard. So you've got to hit it again, and that's where addiction starts to manifest, or dependency, to be kinder. Dependency can start, because people say, well, I'm feeling awful again, I know this works, I'll take this to stop this horrible feeling, regardless of whether I'm dealing with the issue that's causing the feeling or not. And that's a tragedy that our culture is not addressing. And we need to start looking at that, but that means we have to ask harder questions of the culture itself, which, again, is another conversation for another day.
Thank you so much to Robin. And, yes, that is a significant thing that you say when you connect the spiritual with drug taking and those hallucinations, and even the story that you tell about your contact who had that Hindu background, and those sorts of conversations. We do like to have those on this program. Can't enlarge on it today. In fact, we're running out of time. I'll have to draw a line under the calls. Thanks so much to everybody who has participated, because I want to get a significant, just a focus here for a few moments, Shane, on this idea of people being blocked out of the public discourse, blocked out of the way that policies are being formed. People like who are already have been experiencing these things, recovered addicts, or people who are currently using drugs. These people are not being listened to in the debate. And even some of the people that have called in today, I imagine they're not even welcome to make their policy contribution. Give us some insight here, things that we're not being told.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because and there's different reasons why people can't contribute to a debate. So there's a number of factors. We're not going to say there's only one. But what's interesting is that Bordicelli, he was under President Barack Obama in America. Bordicelli was the what they call the drug czar, in other words, head of their drug policy implementation in the U.S. And he made a comment, which I thought was really quite profound. It's on record as saying, we're always concerned that the ex-drug user is not more involved in the conversation around the legalization debate. Now, according to White, a major research in America, 2012, there's over 26 million, that was 2012, 26 million ex-drug users who have been clean for 1 year or more in the US alone. Now, that's 26 million people who have tried drugs for whatever reason, got into drugs, could have been trauma, could have been experimentation, could have been just wanted to be a party animal, whatever, went through that, got addicted, dependent, addicted, then they exited drug use because it was creating a great deal of harm. Other guys who weren't addicted but have left drug use, cannabis use, are Chris Evans, Captain America, Ed Sheeran, he dumped marijuana. He said, they say it made me creative. It didn't. I get more creativity from a cup of tea, and I'm quoting, than cannabis. It actually numbed me. So there's all these people that are exiting drug use, but their conversations aren't allowed. Some of them don't want to talk. But what's fascinating we're finding is if you're a current drug user, then you are welcome to come in and speak into the debate about how to better use syringes, how to have more injecting rooms, how to all those things. Which have importance, no doubt, not about how to exit drug use, but how to keep alive and using drug use until such a time as I deem I want to stop, if I ever do. But it becomes a society's responsibility to keep me alive and healthy, and as I continue ongoing drug use, without recourse for change. And so the legislative framework gives us what we call a judicial educator, enables us to exercise a measure that helps people exit drug use. You take that out, then there is no measurement to other than where a person decides when they want to. And in the meantime, if they were self-sustaining and paying their own way, it wouldn't be a problem. But as we heard from that other lady, they live in car parks. They can't work. They won't work for all sorts of reasons. And therefore, the system has to sustain them as they continue to use drugs. Now, if you're an ex-drug user, we call the recovery alumni, there is an active work to stop those people speaking into the drug debate and actually presenting, particularly, if you like, in school space. We don't have anyone working in our space who's an ex-drug user, but others who want to speak to students in a good quality evidence-based education program, simply because they've used drugs previously and been addicted to drugs, they are actively resisted in being involved. Now, if that same resistance was done to a person who's currently using drugs, and I'm talking about alcohol, not a problem. You can be an alcohol user, even an alcohol misuser, and still be a drug educator. But if you've been an ex-user, for example, an ex-heroin user or an ex-marijuana user, you're not permitted. No, we don't want you. And they've got evidence that they keep wielding out, which is an echo chamber, about why that's not a good idea. And we agree that certainly wielding out an ex-drug user to tell a horror story doesn't work. We know that. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about reducing stigma. We're talking about empowering and exercising incredible use of that person's experience to add value to a holistic resiliency-building alcohol and other drug education program. Now, that's where it becomes a problem. It's saying, hang on, we can talk all day long about how to use drugs more safely, but we're not going to talk about how to stop using drugs and exit drug use.
Yeah.
That's a concern I have, and that's a part of the narrative that's been excised. And our latest DVD resource, again, Drug Policy, Prevent, Don't Promote, Changing the Narrative, a two DVD set, it's quite involved. And we look at this whole area, what's going on in that space, without accusation, without criticizing, just simply explaining what's been happening for the last 50 to 60 years, the last 100 years, when it comes to the war on drugs,
well, Shane,
how that actually works.
I'll point people to how they can get a hold of these resources, and I know you've got a lot of resources people can access on two websites I'll give. One is dalganoinstitute.org.au, but I know that people can get a regular subscription-type mailing with the No Brainer website and nobrainer.org.au. People can sign up there and receive regular updates and get real insights into what's going on with the alcohol and drug space. Shane Varko is the Executive Director of Dalgano Institute, a coalition of alcohol and drug educators. Shane, great insights as always. Thank you so much for taking some time to share these thoughts with listeners today on 2020.
No, my pleasure, Neil. And thank you to the listeners who phoned in too. Really appreciated their input. It's great.
Before you go, thanks for listening.
There's lots more great audio on demand, or you can listen to us live at visionradio.org.au.
And remember, Vision is listener supported. Your donation,
large or small,
will help us continue connecting faith to life for hundreds of thousands of people across Australia and around the world.
Learn more or donate today at visionradio.org.au.